This is Jeff Spittler, January 20th, 2002, The Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 54, A Parliament of Malignants, or maybe we'll call it A Revolution Undone. Okay, from time to time, some of you may wonder, where do I get all this stuff from? And so from time to time I'll bring in some of these books, and I won't pass them around, but you can take a look at them if you'd like. I'll have them up here. This is a source book of Scottish history. It's where a lot of the excerpts of the important acts of Parliament and so on are found. I bought this one before. It's called King or Covenant by David Stevenson. It's a series of short biographies, including today we're going to mention Archibald Johnson of Warriston. This should be in every Covenanter home here. The Scots Worthies by John Howie. It's a series of biographies of Covenanters. It's an interesting reading. Like some of you may have read it to your kids before. I think Alan, did you? Yeah. They weren't too bored, were they?
We're working on them,
yeah. This is really exciting reading. The Dictionary of Scottish Church History and Theology. Now, actually, this is a very useful reference, and if you're invaluable if you're doing this kind of study. This is a book by an Episcopalian writer, Bishop Gilbert Burnett, or Burnet. I'm not really sure how it's said. I guess Scottish, so what do you think, Simon? Yeah. Okay, he will commit. It's called History of His Own Time. This is the abridged version, but he wrote quite a bit about the Covenanters, but also about Charles and so on. Somewhat biased of a writer, but still useful. I mean, you know, if he says that the Covenanter ministers were devout and, you know, so on and so forth, he's coming from the other perspective. So, on the other hand, if he says bad things about him, you can take it with a grain of salt. So, okay. And finally, this is the rare-bound photocopy version of a book called The Covenanters, The History of the Church in Scotland from the Reformation to the Revolution. This is, if there's one book we're following in this class, it's, this is it. This is actually the second volume. The two original volumes, which I had checked out from a library when I was living in England, was got it on interlibrary loan from some Scottish university. Two volumes about this thick altogether, sort of big bound volumes. It was published in Glasgow in 1908. So, anyway, so we'll quote some from some of this today. Okay, so last time, besides our review of the first, two millenniums or whatever of a millennium and a half of Scottish church history, we covered the Restoration with special emphasis on how some of the protesters were arrested and how the killing began with the Marquis of Argyll and Minister James Guthrie. I mentioned that the Scottish Parliament was convened, that they, and then they tried Argyll and Guthrie, and I sort of jumped ahead. They also passed a number of acts and did some other things that we'd like to bring up, so we're going to back up. See, in this class, it's two steps forward, one step back, sort of progress through history. So they met from the 1st of January, 1661, to the 12th of July. They produced in that time nearly 400 acts. In that time, with those 400 acts, or actually with just a few of them, they almost completely overthrew the gains that the Covenanters had made from 1638 to, most of the gains were made to 1650, but they had very nearly overthrew everything. It's not, you could point out a few exceptions, which we'll get to, but their very first act passed, I think, the very first day, was an oath of allegiance that would be necessary to hold a seat in Parliament, which included, "I acknowledge my said sovereign, only supreme governor of this kingdom over all persons and in all causes. Renounce and forsake all foreign power, and shall never decline his majesty's power and jurisdiction, as I shall answer to God." So if you were listened to the first part of the class, you know, in the early 1600s, this was exactly what one of the issues was. The whole business about the tale of two kingdoms is, are there two kingdoms? One is the church and Christ's kingdom, and the other is the civil magistrate run by the king, right? And then the church is run not by the pontiff or bishop, but rather by Christ himself, and that's the claim of the Presbyterian system. Hope other systems too, but it may not be so direct. So this by itself was enough to undo many of the gains that had been made by the Covenanters. You might have thought that Charles II would have learned some lessons from what his father went through, but evidently the lessons he'd learned aren't the ones that a careful student in this class might draw. So, okay, a few members of Parliament tried to have the word civil inserted in this oath so that the king would be the supreme civil authority and not also the supreme ecclesiastical authority. They were unsuccessful. The Earl of Middleton, who was running things at this point for the king, assured everyone there was no intention for the king to take up ecclesiastical authority. One of those members, the Earl of Cassilis, he was later thrown out of, you know, disbarred from holding office because for refusing to take this oath. So it wasn't that there was no one in the Parliament who was sympathetic to the Covenanters, but they were in a minority. Sir Archibald Johnston of Warriston, who had been co-author of the National Covenant, he wrote the one part on the legal precedents. He was clerk of the General Assembly in 1638, the one who had the minutes that were from the desirable precedents rather than from the more recent years. A representative of the Westminster Assembly, a staunch protester. He compounded his sins in the eyes of Parliament by finally, during the interregnum, accepting this position of clerk register under Cromwell. So he, in one sense, complied with the English government. He had testified against them, but he was somewhat impoverished, and I think finally he decided that he would have to, you know, give in and take up this job, which was similar to the job he'd held before. And for that, he was called up before Parliament. As explained by David Stevenson, Warriston was not against monarchy or even against Charles. But from Charles's point of view, when he had been in Scotland, it had been Warriston who had brought catastrophe to the campaign against the English by purging. This is kind of funny because, of course, even though once they unpurged the army and brought in all these other people, they had basically the same disastrous outcome. Who had been mainly responsible for religious divisions which had split the country, who had lectured the king on how godly he must be before he could have power, and on his morals. That was probably the most offensive thing to Charles. His supporters wanted vengeance on Warriston, and the king was determined that he would be one of a handful of Scots who paid the ultimate penalty. Incidentally, that handful is ones that paid it early on. There was quite a few that paid it later. The second act of Parliament turned Warriston out of office and declared him a traitor. He was able to flee the country, but he was later tracked down in France. It's claimed by some that he was poisoned by the king's physician. I don't know if this is true or not. But he was when he was brought back to Edinburgh, he was in quite a bit of mental distress, and some people attribute this to him being poisoned. He was finally executed in July of 1663 after being extradited from France. Let's see, on the 25th of January 1661, there was an act passed that forbade the renewing of the covenants without the king's approval. Okay, they weren't completely rejected at that point, they were just it was just forbidden to renew them. So shortly thereafter, an act was passed which allowed the restoration of patronage, right, where royalist ministers could be appointed to churches, say by the local laird or duke or whatever, without consent of the congregation. And this, of course, was, you know, one more step in overthrowing the not the, I'll say, that overthrowing the Covenanter. Okay, well, apparently weary, I mean, with 400 acts in 7 months, I guess you'd get tired of this. Apparently weary of overthrowing the Covenanters in a piecemeal manner, the Earl of Middleton and his advisors settled on a more comprehensive approach. They came up with the act called the so-called Act Recessory. Okay. It annulled all the acts of Scottish parliaments from 1640 to 1649 in one fell swoop. Okay, this included acts that were passed while Charles I was in Scotland sitting over the parliament. Okay, but this was towards the beginning of the English Civil War, and Charles was under quite a bit of pressure and was probably induced to pass. I'm sure he was passed things that he would not care to pass, but that he passed them thinking that he could overturn them later, as he wrote in some letters. Well, Gilbert Burnett, the Episcopalian writer I mentioned earlier, said this was a most extravagant act, making a fatal precedent and destroying all security in government. Of its effect, he said, the truth is Scotland at this time was in a very distracted condition. The Recessory Act had unhinged everything. An act of indemnity had not yet passed, and the severe, rather cruel proceedings against such as were attainted hung like a black and lowering cloud over everyone's head, uncertain where the storm was next to fall. Okay, well, to give you some idea of the tenor of the Parliament and the Act, I'd like to quote from a fair amount of it. It's a little bit long, but it gives you an example of sort of the what was in the air. The Estates of Parliament, considering that the peace and happiness of this kingdom and of His Majesty's good subjects therein doth depend upon the safety of His Majesty's person and the maintenance of His royal authority, power, and greatness, and that all the miseries, confusions, and disorders which this kingdom hath groaned under these 23 years have issued from and been the necessary and natural products of these neglects, contempts, and invasions, which in and from the beginning of these troubles were upon the spacious, but false, pretext of reformation, the common cloak of all rebellion, offered unto the sacred person and royal authority of the King's Majesty and his royal father of blessed memory. Okay, so in other words, the causes of all the problems of the last 23 years is not Charles I and the Stuart philosophy of absolute monarchy, but rather the cause is these people pretending reformation, the common cloak of all rebellion. So even though there were more acts to come and so on, I mean, you can pretty much read the writing on the wall. Let's see. And although the late King's Majesty, out of his mere grace and respects to this his native kingdom and the peace and quiet of his people, and for preventing the consequences which such a bad example and practice might occasion to the disturbance of the peace of his other kingdoms, was pleased in the year 1641 to come into this country and by his own presence at their pretended parliaments, and otherwise to comply with and give way to many things nearly concerning the undoubted interest and prerogative of the crown, expecting that such unparalleled condescension should have made his subjects ashamed of their former miscarriages, and the very thoughts thereof to be hateful to them and their posterity forever. Yet such was the prevalency of the spirit of the rebellion that raged in many of the time, that, not content with of that peace and happiness which even above their desires was secured unto them, nor of those many grants of honor and profit by which His Majesty endeavored to endear the most desperate of them to their duty and obedience, they then, when His Majesty had not left unto them any pretense or shadow of any new desire to be proposed, either considering themselves of the kingdom, did most unworthily engage to subvert His Majesty's government and the public peace of the kingdom of England. For which purpose, having joined in a league with some there, the Parliament, basically, they, for the better prosecution of the same, did assume unto themselves the royal power, kept and held parliaments at their pleasure. It goes on from there, and you know, and then finally says that therefore the King's Majesty and Estates of Parliament do hereby rescind and annul the pretended parliaments kept in the years 1640. Da, 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 they're enumerated each one, and all acts and deeds passed and done in them, and declare the same henceforth void and null. Okay. In any case, that's sort of the tenor of the Act, and much of the Parliament and succeeding Parliaments go along pretty much on the same theme. In other words, we have supporters of the absolute monarchy, and this is why things aren't going to go very well from the Covenanters. Like I said, it's all sort of all downhill from here. Okay, the Parliament continued. They established Restoration Day, the 29th of May, as a holiday. They penalized people who were married by ministers not part of the established church. And this is sort of irrelevant but they to our study, but I'll bring it up anyways. Commissioned judges to execute witches, mostly women, who scared the Earl of Haddington's tenantry off of his lands. So, there's still in Scotland at this time, there's still, you know, there's still sort of a pagan undercurrent with the, you know, witches and, you know, various sorts of superstitions and so on that say a lot stronger than it is today. I mean, we still have some remnants of these things, but anyways, that they dealt with that. That's interestingly enough, one of the reasons they probably had to deal with this way is the under the Commonwealth government, the I'm not sure about penalizing witches in general, but they wouldn't torture them. Okay, and that was sort of standard practice, is you would torture witches. And anyways. Okay. Beyond this, the Parliament, they got busy with the trials of Argyll and Guthrie and actually a few other people, which we won't get into. We'll get into some. Okay, they also called Samuel Rutherford to appear before them on a charge of treason. Okay, earlier I mentioned the Committee of Estates had banned Lex Rex, and I couldn't remember, but I did find it now several places, that it was burnt by the common hangman at the cross in Edinburgh and under the windows of Newth College in St. Andrews. In other words, where Rutherford was. Robert Bailey, the resolutioner, minister, and writer, said Mr. Rutherford had not death prevented was in the same hazard, in other words, as Guthrie, of being executed. And quoting from Howey, the Scots Worthies, it is commonly said that when the summons came, he, Samuel Rutherford, spoke out of his bed and said, "Tell them I have got a summons already before a superior judge and judicatory, and I behove to answer my first summons, and ere your day come, I will be where few kings and great folks come." Okay. When they returned and told he was a-dying, the Parliament was put to a vote whether or not to let him die in the college. It was carried, put him out, only a few dissenting. My Lord Burleigh said, "Ye have voted that honest man out of the college, but you cannot vote him out of heaven." Some said he would never win there, hell was too good for him. Burleigh said, "I wish I were as sure of heaven as he is. I would think myself happy to get a grip of his sleeve to haul me in." So, okay, so this was in mid-March 1661, and Rutherford was very sick at the time. He died on the 29th of March 1661. Okay, some of the other well-known protesters got off more lightly than Guthrie. In other words, they weren't executed. Patrick Gillespie, George Gillespie's younger brother, and Sir Robert Bailey's nemesis, was called up before Parliament on the 6th of March, 1661. And, let's see, quoting from Hewison, "Being of a more elastic temperament in face of peril than were his fellow prisoners, he was induced to put an acceptable construction upon his attitude to the remonstrance and to the causes. He threw himself on the mercy of the king, and he was confined within 6 miles of Ormiston in East Lothian, a rural village." Okay, so he escaped any more serious penalty. Robert McWard, a Glasgow minister, a former student of Samuel Rutherford, and his we'd probably call him a secretary. He's referred to as his amanuensis. Preached a sermon against Parliament's overthrow of the Covenant and Reformation. For that, he was called before Parliament and found guilty of sedition on the 7th of June, 1661. He was banished from Scotland. He went to the Netherlands, or to Holland, and there he became a stench in Charles's nostrils anyways, despite his distance. He and his colleague, John Brown of Wamphray, who was also exiled, wrote a number of tracts and books supporting the Covenanters. He became the Scots pastor in Rotterdam, and as Hewison said, his manse was long the rendezvous of the exiled, the headquarters whence issued many communications and sometimes pistols to the persecuted at home. Alexander Moncrief, a Protestant minister who was picked up at the same time as James Guthrie in August of 1660, remained in prison while Parliament debated his punishment for co-authoring the Remonstrance and owning the principles of Guthrie's Causes of God's Wrath upon Scotland. There were some members of Parliament who were sympathetic to Moncrief. They tried to get his wife to prevail with him to recede from some of his principles. Otherwise, they told her it was impossible to save his life. This excellent woman answered that they all knew she was happy and a good husband, and she had a great affection for him and had many children. Yet she knew him to be so steadfast to his principles where his conscience was concerned that nobody needed deal with him on that head. For her part, before she would contribute anything that would break his peace with his master, she would rather choose to receive his head at the cross. In other words, his head cut off at the common place of execution in Edinburgh. He languished in prison for a while. I think he got ill, and some of the sympathetic members of Parliament were apparently able to sort of placate the more vindictive ones. In any case, the Fuhrer in Parliament Society, he was only banned from holding any public or ecclesiastical office, and he was banned from his parish. So later, he was often to be in trouble with the law for preaching and so on, and preaching at conventicles and that. He was sought many times. There's sort of many stories of miraculous escapes, but he wasn't apprehended. He died naturally in 1688. Robert Trail, an Edinburgh minister, also one of the ones arrested with James Guthrie, was tried by the Lords of the Articles. And this is like a committee of Parliament. In August of 1661, he was allowed to remain in Edinburgh, but was later tried by Parliament and banished from Scotland in December 1662. His wife, in 1665, was actually imprisoned for writing to him. Okay, you'll see one of the things that comes out later is that a number of these ministers that are being pursued by the law have these letters of intercommuning placed against them. In other words, it becomes a crime to communicate with this person. While he was in prison awaiting his trial, he wrote to Thomas Wiley, who's a minister in the town that's spelled Kirkcudbright but pronounced Kirkabry. "I need not write to you how matters go here. This I must say, your imprisoned brethren are kindly dealt with by our good Lord, for whose cause and interest we suffer. And if any of us be straitened, it is not in him, for we have large allowance from him, could we take it. We know it fares the better with us that you and such as you remember us at the throne. We are waiting from day to day to see what men will do with us. At best we are expecting banishment, but our sentence must proceed from the Lord, and whatsoever it shall be, it is good from him. And whithersoever he is willing to send us, we know that he shall be with us, and shall let us know that the earth is his and the fullness thereof." So that was included in the book by Howie. Okay. Next time we're going to start with the sort of machinations to actually overthrow the church by putting in bishops and the like and ejecting a lot of the ministers. But we're going to hear a lot from here on out about the Covenanters under persecution. And I think when people are being persecuted, you get sort of a one-sided picture of this sort of, you know, how they performed or how they behaved as martyrs and, you know, under really desperate situations. But I thought right where we're at, we're right at the sort of a change in Scotland. I thought it would be useful to discuss a little bit about what they were like under more normal conditions. This might be necessary perhaps because the Covenanters have been slandered in history with the sort of same sort of caricatures as the early American Puritans. In other words, that they were, to paraphrase Mencken, they were dour killjoys that were always worried that somewhere someone else might be having fun. Okay. And I actually can remember talking to one elder member of the Reformed Presbyterian Church who was talking about this and said in effect, well, they probably were pretty dour. you often hear them, when they're under persecution, taking a stand for some what may seem like a small principle and being very rigid. But there is sort of another side. First, just to give you an idea, this where does these caricatures come from? Well, one place is a history written by Buckle in the shortly thereafter, late 17th, early 18th century, somewhere in there. Buckle said things like, "I will not be deterred from letting this age see the real character of a system which aimed at destroying all human happiness, exciting slavish and abject fear, and turning this glorious world into one vast theater of woe." Okay, another passage he wrote, "Whatever was natural was wrong. The clergy deprived the people of their holidays, their amusements, their shows, their games, and their sports. They repressed every appearance of joy. They forbade all merriment. They stopped all festivities. They choked up every avenue by which pleasure could enter, and they spread over the country in a universal gloom." Okay. This is a pretty severe indictment, pretty manifestly false also, but it's, there's a few half-truths in it. Let's see, of their sermons he declared, "There is in these productions a hardness of heart, an austerity of temper, a want of sympathy with human nature, such as have rarely been exhibited in any age, and I rejoice to think have never been exhibited in any other Protestant country." He said, "The Scots preachers sought to destroy not only human pleasures, but also human affections. A Christian had no business with love or sympathy." Okay, this is, very, very far from the mark. James King Hewson, again writing in the very earliest part of the last century, published in 1908, felt it was necessary, sort of at length, to rebut this view. And I'm going to quote bits and pieces of stuff that he wrote. A lot of it's anecdotal, examples of just various examples that sort of rebut Buckle's view. Let's see. This kind of goes back and forth, some about the ministers and what they were like, and then some about the people. And so let's start here with general discussion of some of the ministers. The student, keeping in view the fact that the Covenanters had high ideals and noble aims, namely to make every individual recognize his own responsibility for the temporal and eternal welfare of himself and his neighbors in accordance with the law of love in Jesus Christ, has a key to unlock all the mysteries of the distracted age of the Covenants. If he turns to the life of Andrew Donaldson, minister of Dalgety, he will find these ideals and aims largely realized in one man, who may be accepted as the type of the true Presbyterian, and also made practical in that Fifeshire parish where the minister labored to elevate peer and peasant alike, to educate all the children, to feed, clothe, and protect the poor, to assist the indigent at home and the unfortunate abroad, to act the soldier in the hour of peril, and to repress vice. It can be demonstrated that the Covenanters practiced what they preached, purity of life, truthfulness, and honesty, and further, that nearly every one of these repressive measures, inspired by the Church for the curbing of vice and mitigating disease, drunkenness, profanity, Sabbath breaking, have been or are being, in our own day, reenacted by intelligent governments. don't always agree with Hewison's view of what intelligent government is, but so that for the good of the many, the suspect, the unsavory, and the undesirable, whether alien or not, are being constantly policed. The most enlightened republics today ask from immigrants the same certificate of respectability and ability to work which Kirk Sessions 2.5 centuries ago demanded from the incomers. 3.5 centuries ago now. Nor is it to be forgotten that these sessions were virtually magisterial courts, with one educated cleric presiding over many laymen judging petty offenses. Surely as good a system of local government magistracy as our present rural and burgle system, whereby many an ill-informed justice of the peace disposes of trivial cases to the best of his judgment. Okay, about the clergy. The Scots' pre-Restoration clergy were not the plebeian class, nor the illiterates that Macaulay made out their English brethren, on the whole, in 1685 to be, the generality of whom were considered unusually lucky if each of them had, this is the English clergy, 10 or 12 dog-eared volumes among the pots and pans on his shelves. The Scots clergy, abhorring celibacy, cultivated domestic and social happiness, and were noted for hospitality, toleration, and humanity, which they enjoined on others. Few histories can produce so many illustrations of parental and filial affection as are found in the biographies of the persecuted. The pathetic stories of Guthrie, this is James Guthrie and his Willie's 5-year-old son, and then lists off a number of other names. Let's see, so far from Birking, human joys and banning amusements, I don't know if that's a forerunner of Borking. The clergy encouraged every elevating custom and only set themselves against those scenes of riot where vicious men pervade incitements to wickedness for the debased and lascivious. And give some examples here, but they won't make sense to us. Let's see. Okay, now turning more to the Scots' attitude toward things like music, says the Scots loved the harp, the harpsichord, the viol, and the flute, and still more the sweet voices which sang those martial ballads and love lyrics which still charm the dainty ear. Simon, the master of Lovat, had a wonderful fancy for music, variety of which he had still by him, the harp, virginals, bass, and treble, viol, and consort. Mr. John Houston, the minister of Wardlaw, covenanter and member of the 1638 Assembly, and his son, Mr. Thomas, were great musicians, vocal and instrumental, who frequently attended. Okay, turning to celebrations, in 1642, the year before the Solemn League and Covenant was made, the new master, Hugh Fraser, married Anna, daughter of Lord Leven, in Holyrood House. They came to Buncrew, and the diarist wrote, "It is an extravagant rant to speak of the glory and expense of this sumptuous wedding feast, where we are informed the merry, jovial, facetious society, the Earl of Sutherland, a notable covenanter, and his friends, had liquors of all sorts, meat, mirth, music, and good management of all things, besides indulging in Highland games and sport." 20 years later, similar festivities took place in Darnaway Castle at the wedding of Sir Hugh Calder. Okay, now, presumably, it didn't just happen every 20 years, but there's relatively few, you know, there's relatively few accounts that you might get this from. The kingdom could not afford better wines than was drunk and music of all sorts. Edom Smith mastered the musicians in Murray for virginal violins, harp, and organ was Calder's domestic. We spent that day in a charming converse of sport, gaming, and singing. That's from a diary of the time. Let's see. Mentioned some other sports. People are getting together to sing. Let's see, yeah, some more people lending instruments, just, you know, a number of sort of things in the contemporary writings indicating that, say, musical instruments and music and so on were not uncommon, contrary to what Buckle, you might think from Buckle. An anecdote regarding Henry Erskine, the father of Ralph and Ebenezer Erskine, some of you are familiar with. He was ejected, and I'll probably get to this next week, ministers being ejected from their parishes for refusing to refusing to submit to Episcopalian government. One evening, his wife and children went to bed with a light supper, which made the children cry in the morning when they awaked for meat. But there being none in the house, he bade them be still, and he would play them a spring upon the citron, his guitar. Okay, he played and wept. Before he'd done playing, a charitable lady sent him a horse load of provisions. Okay. Now, the next few you will know that I had to include in the lesson. John Erskine of Carnock, the Covenanter, recorded in his diary that his father sent him to learn dancing and that he also enjoyed a game at bias bowls and went gunning and cod hunting. Okay, that's fox hunting. The more straight-laced, like Patrick Walker, who had escaped the gallows and plantations, would not... Well, I'm going to read this, although I can't really tell you what it means. Crook a hoff to fike and fling at pipers and fiddler springs. He gives a satisfactory reason thus: I bless the Lord that ordered my lot so in my dancing days, that made the fear of the bloody rope and bullets to my neck and head, the pain of boots, thumbkins and irons, cold and hunger, wetness and weariness, to stop the lightness of my head and the wantonness of my feet. Argyle, with his family and household, in January 1667, celebrated a marriage, drinking, dancing, as merry as you could wish. William Guthrie of Fenwick, this is James Guthrie's cousin, was both a fowler and a fisher. Okay, and his primitive curling stone is still preserved. Levin and King Charles played golf at the Scottish camp. In the Covenanting period, not a single act against games appears on the statute book. Okay. Now, the reason somebody like Buckle would say, oh, they, you know, want to get rid of the people's amusements, is because the Covenanters did have a very high view of the Sabbath, right? So, and James had passed this Sabbath, you know, thing where, you know, the people would go out and, you know, play sports and so on after after church. And what's that? Okay. Okay, so later, right, when he says the men of the covenant were imbued with a deep-seated love for every good thing, but as they had to fight for essentials, they had no more opportunities than other soldiers in a protracted campaign to become occupied with arts, crafts, or ephemeral entertainments that did not make for the moral welfare of the people. In other words, once they were under persecution, there was no, you know, probably not too many like music recitals and the like being held. Still, maybe, you know, duck hunting and fishing still, because they had to eat. But talks about family life. Livingston narrates how he got a, quote, marriage affection for his bride after prayer. But thereafter, he honestly confesses, I had a great difficulty to moderate it. So, okay, none of the ministers left money from the poor. Some, like Alexander Henderson, for education. Many supported library at Glasgow University. Number of counts of ministers, you know, helping the poor. Let's see. Some retained their, he says, mother wit till death, even on the scaffold. William Guthrie, minister of Fenwick, was cheerful and facetious, yet tempered with gravity, as becometh a minister of Christ. He was wont to indulge in singular sallies of wit and innocent mirth. Okay, that's, yeah, that was the guy who fished and duck on it, of course. Okay. Skip over that and a little bit about the sort of the status of education, like at the king's return, in other words, at the restoration, every village had a school, every family almost had a Bible. Yea, in most of the country, all the children of age could read the scriptures and were furnished with Bibles either by the parents or by the ministers. And this is in stark, stark contrast to the situation in, say, roughly 100 years earlier when the First Reformation occurred. Every minister was obliged to preach thrice a week, to lecture and catechize once, besides other private duties. Indeed, in many places, the Spirit seemed to be poured out with the Word, both by the multitude of sincere converts, and also by the common work of reformation on many who never came the length of a communion. There were no fewer than 60 aged people, men and women, who went to school, but even then they might be able to read the scriptures with their own eyes. Let's see, and this is speaking of a particular parish. Okay. I have lived many years in a parish, actually he's quoting from Kirkton, a historian at the time. I've lived many years in a parish where I never heard an oath, and you might have ridden many miles before you had heard any. Every family, too, had family worship. He says there's some other, Hewson goes on to report on some other corroborating, you know, accounts. Here, in New Mills during one winter, 40 persons, all above 40 years of age, learned to read that they might profit by reading the scriptures. Other evidence that wasn't unique, a little bit about this parish of Dalgety. The parish was fully equipped. Nobility, gentry, and humble parishioners formed a Kirk session, 15 in number. 6 deacons cared for the poor. During the ministry of Donaldson, the church was repaired and a school and schoolhouse were erected for the first time. A committee of the session regularly visited the school in which poor and rich were taught together, the poor being provided with fees and food. It was enacted that little herd boys be not neglected, but sent to church and to the catechizing every second or third Sabbath, so as to be, quote, bred up in the knowledge of the grounds of religion, all being kept at school till they were able to read the Bible. The General Assembly of 1642 had appointed the 3 R's as the minimum of rural education, namely reading, writing, and... Sorry, Alan, not arithmetic, religion. Poor bodies got Bibles free, no fewer than 11 Bibles costing £2 Scots each, being given away in 1 month in 1654. In 1645, the minister himself went to the war. Under such a pastor, and he was only one among many such, the whole tone of the parish was raised. Humanitarianism was the rule. Hence we find the poor cared for, a lame soldier provided for, a collection taken for a man whose horses were suffocated, the pestilence fought, and the uncharitable publicly rebuked for their hardness of heart. Elders visited all the congregation once a month to deepen the Christian life. Could the English critic have produced any individual or parochial parallels to such love of the brethren? So, okay, and there's a number of other examples, and he's trying to sort of prove his point about the sort of state of affairs under the Covenanters. And actually, next week, I think, when we talk about the ejection of ministers and the replacement with Episcopalians and so on, I'll read you a passage from Gilbert Burnett, who basically confirms the state of the Scottish clergy, even though he didn't like their sermons necessarily. And he also admits the very low state of the prelates that were introduced. Okay, well, out of time. So, any questions? Okay, Dan, then Mary, then Bruce.
Well, I was just going to make one comment. I'm thinking about the notion that the Reformation of the Church is the cloak of rebellion. I'm not sure if it's universal, but almost universal assumption that despots make through the centuries. Even to this day, the oppressive despotic regime assumes that the Reformation of the Church is a cloak for rebellion. And the student of history, I mean, not without cause, I think. I mean, the student of history, from just looking at it from a worldly perspective, sees that often the overthrow of regime follows the Reformation of the Church, I think. They don't understand God's sovereignty and God's ways and God's blessing on his people, but it's a universal assumption. It sort of occurred to me that it was, and that it's not wholly without cause. I mean, they ought to worry about the church being reformed, because historically speaking, their days are numbered. Once God's people move on.
Quite so. Mary?
Well,
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This is our unnatural. Yeah, no. Right. That's part of his point. They weren't these sort of rigid, dour killjoys that, didn't have any. I mean, Buckle says they didn't have any human sympathy or something like that. And that's manifestly false. So. Bruce?
This last week, I just caught, I don't know if anybody else heard on NPR, a fellow who had finished a book, and he was investigating why Western civilization owes a disproportionate amount of great thanks to Scottish people.
I didn't hear Melody mention it to me. I was going to go check it out, but
I only caught just the tail end of it, and then I caught somebody who wrote in saying that why the news guy didn't ask him about the contribution of women, but I didn't know if you had heard the article or I got the impression though that it wasn't the Reformation and biblical thinking that the guy was going to attribute that to. But in your reading, do you see some of these kinds of great contributions?
Well, yeah, I think so. They've contributed in a number of ways, but I think directly, very directly to our own American, revolution and form of government and so on. That was a as some of the English said at the time, that Cousin America's run off with the Presbyterian parson. And, indeed, our own sort of Republican form of government largely is an echo or reflection of Presbyterian hierarchical church government. So yeah, I think there's quite a bit.
Lex Rex is a significant work from a contribution to the... Because it was in this idea that law is king.
Yeah. No, largely we're a reaction against the Stuart philosophy of absolute monarchy. So, I think there's quite a few contributions that could be traced. Also, quite a few inventions and so on, I think, follow from sort of the rigorous Scottish educational system. So, barbarians at the gate again. Quickly, Brian, then Mike.
The work of Rucker, couldn't that be traced all the way back to Calvin? The forming of the camp in Geneva was a unique government at that time, but yet he based that on the Presbyterian form of church government outlined in the Bible.
Yeah, I don't want to say it was just the Scottish contribution. I mean, I also have Swiss ancestors that came to America before the Revolution, fought in the Revolutionary War. So, of course, it had to was partly due to that.
And John Knox was there in Geneva, whether he picked that up and brought that back to Scotland.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he picked up quite a few things. And at the time, there was quite a bit of communication between the party's interest in Reformation. It wasn't as if something just arose in Scotland. But because of the Stuart absolutist monarchy and the relatively large number of Scots who were able to challenge that, probably in Scotland this anti-absolute monarchical philosophy probably reached its sort of fullest fruition. So, Mike.
I just thought it was quite insightful of King Charles to overthrow true religion to go after the Sabbath. I think that in the Christian world, you can't have true religion without the Sabbath. And if you're going to take and stop true religion, I don't know if it's similar, how you feel about it. You go after, you know, kind of football. We're, my mom was talking about, your children can be 4-H because all their show animals are in the
Yeah, he found a number of paths to go after the true religion, so, including that. Okay.